Very good enough.
I'm so proud of myself that I come off as sweet and adorable. That's not the case. I'm Camille Botello. I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since September 19th of 2005. And for that, I'm really grateful. And that's not my original sobriety date. I came in May of that year. And 4 months in, we were at the Taos Mountain Fiesta. It was a great conference, much like this one. And I went out after the Saturday night speaker, and I drank. And ended up at this weird party with like fire-breathing robots that were fighting each other, and it was strange. But the next day, I showed up to the conference, and I sat down, and I didn't realize that there was a sobriety countdown. And I had not prepared my story yet, and I had a scary sponsor. So she was sitting next to me, and so when 4 months came along, you know, she nudged me, and I stood up. And then I proceeded to lie about it for the next 6 years. And the reason I tell you that from the podium, first, is to lower your expectations. And the second reason is, really, I just want to get us all on the same page that I'm essentially just a really big spaz, you know? That's what we're working with this morning. And the second reason is that was the thing that I wasn't going to tell anybody. You know, that was my still beating heart. That was the thing where, you know, when somebody would ask me, the book would ask me, or rhetorically someone would ask me if I was being rigorously honest, I would say yes, but then the but, you know, and that was always in the back of my head. And it was something that I was deeply ashamed of because I wanted to enjoy a reputation that I knew in my heart I didn't deserve. And so releasing that at 6 years sober, I think, opened me up to more of the process. I wanted to thank the committee for having me out here. Ty, who's been lovely, and Dawn, who drove us through the clouds to get here, and Veronica, my road dog, for coming out here with me, and then Melissa and Beth for we drove down the coast a little bit and went out to Haystack Rock, and I drank in Seaside. I drank all up and down this coast, and I love the opportunity to be able to go back to these places and like touch the trees and touch the sand and just be like, I'm okay now, you know, because my last memory of the coast here is like, you know, a mouthful of sand and vodka, you know, just passed out. So I'm reassuring all the plants and animals that I'm okay, and which I am. And it was a beautiful moment being able to go out there and feel like I get to make a different imprint on this place today. And that's because of the opportunity you guys have afforded me to have a psychic change. And I'm also a weeper, like Jack. So just to prepare everybody, I'm also an empathetic crier, and so if anybody else starts crying, I start crying. So if Jack and I were in a room together and we were talking about our lives, like, we would flood the room, and it would be ugly, and I ugly cry, which I've accepted. But I'm just prepare you guys for that. On the big screen, too, does that look good? You know, I'm of the belief that I was an alcoholic when I was born. I felt born with my skin inside out. You know, I it was characterized for me by deep resentments at an early age. I had a very keen sense of justice. I believed in fairness. And I have a 2.5-year-old who's in a little toddler program, and I had a parent-teacher conference with this teacher the other day, and she was happily announcing to me, like, he really cares about what's fair. And I, like, my life flashed before my eyes, and because for me, it didn't come out with any sort of nobility or morality. Like, I had just come up with this really arbitrary sense of how the world should run, and it was based upon my beliefs. And you guys obviously didn't get my copious memos. And so the first time I remember it being a problem, I was in preschool, and it was Halloween, and I was dressed up as Pocahontas warrior princess because she got weapons. And there was this other little girl who was, she was blonde hair, blue eyed, and just perfect, and she was dressed up as Bridal Barbie, and it wasn't fair. And I took that, and I started plotting. So about 3 or 4 months later, I got my mom to invite her over for a play date, and this was up in Denver, and so they had basements up there. So I lured her down into our basement, I shut off the lights, and I locked the door. And And so when I saw Silence of the Lambs later, like, I was like, oh my God, it's me. So I was thirsty when by the time I took my first drink. I was 12 years old, and I had a sister who I was really, really close to, and she also suffered from this disease, and she was significantly older than me. I thought she was the cool sister. Like, turns out sometimes she'd kidnap me from school and stuff, but I have no memory of that. But when I was 12, I got the news that she had had a suicide attempt, and what she had done was she had gone out to the garage and poured Bacardi on herself and lighter fluid and lit herself on fire. And the whole bottom half of her body was covered in third-degree burns. And what I started to learn that day is that we don't die quick and painless when we're drinking. We die slow and painful deaths. And she didn't die that day. And my solution was not to seek out comfort from my parents. It wasn't to talk about my feels. It was to find the bottle of Bacardi and drink. And there was something... something really intuitive about knowing that it's not in that bottle, I'm going to feel different. And what alcohol has done for me from the get-go has narrowed my focus. I was always somebody that got overwhelmed with too much stuff going on, and alcohol could make me present, you know. And it's ironic that what I'm trying to find in Alcoholics Anonymous is the fourth dimension of presence, and that's what I found with alcohol. But eventually, that stopped working, and so my drinking was not social. It was not. It was not, you know, curious. It was for effect. And I went through the rest of my schooling very, very concerned with the mask. You know, I was I would never got in trouble. I was the president of Students Against Drunk Driving, which turned out to be ironic. And I just put so much effort into showing you that I was okay. And not only was I okay, I was better than you. And so senior year rolls around, and by this time I'm a daily drinker. In the morning I'm drinking Chardonnay because it's classy. During the day I'm drinking Robitussin because they're not going to really look at you funny if you have Robitussin as opposed to a flask. Like, I was smart. And at the end of the day I would raid my parents' liquor cabinet. My parents had the belief that if you kept alcohol up high, then I couldn't get to it. They still do it. I'm 36. They still keep their alcohol up high so I can't reach it. And so I would, you know, I'd drag the chair over to the liquor cabinet, and I'd that would be the end of my day. And by the time I was 16, 17, 18 years old, there wasn't a day that went by when I was not drinking. And when I was 18, I was college bound. It was September. I got a call, and it was like, Camille, your sister's in the hospital again. And I was like, oh, God, another one, you know, just another cry for help. And I went over to the hospital, and she was in the ICU, and I hadn't seen her for about a year, and I didn't know that she had been trying to get sober in that time, and I looked at her in the bed, and it turns out she had developed small cell lung cancer, and it spread to her liver and her bloodstream, and she had TB from one of her stints in an insane asylum, and she had Hep C, and so her liver was bloated, and she was skeletal, and she was gray and shrunken. And the nurses said, you know, she's probably not going to be lucid for very much longer. You should probably say goodbye now. And I said goodbye to my sister. And this was my person. And when I sat there with her, she wasn't able to acknowledge me. But I wasn't sober when I did it. You know, I wasn't able to express to her how much she meant to me. And you know. Of course, later on, I get to see the example that she set for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? So I wasn't able to do that with her, and that's a regret that I have that hasn't felt amended. And I don't know when that amendment will come. But I sat with her, and my dad made the decision to pull the plug on life support for her, and I didn't speak to him for another 4 years, because in my head, he killed her. She went into hospice care, and she had burned so many bridges, my parents weren't capable of sitting with her while she died. And her husband at the time gave me Psalm 23 to read to her. And it's the, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou art with me. And my immediate reaction to that was one of deep rage. And there was an emptiness to that psalm. There was hollowness. Any semblance of seeking God that I had had in my life was gone. It's out the window. It was done. Because of our battle cry, look what you're doing to me. And And her death was very much about me. It happened to me. It didn't happen to anybody else. It was mine. And I was off and running. I went up to college in Portland, Oregon. Go Pios, you know. It was a small little liberal arts college, and it was great because I, like, all of a sudden, nobody was watching me. And I would do things like change my name pretty often. Like when I was 9, I changed my name. I used to go by Camille, and then I started to go by Casey. And then when I went back to college, I changed my name again. And so, like, whenever I get a mortgage, I have like 16 aliases. So I changed my name because I was like, okay, it's a new start. And I'm keeping a bum jug of Carla Rossi under my desk, and I'm starting to fail my classes. And on all of these lines that I wasn't going to step over, I got put on academic probation for plagiarism. And I lost my scholarship, and I'm starting to feel like I can't go out during the day. I moved into a place down in Northwest, and very conveniently above a bar, below, you know, next to a bar, across from a bar, and then there was a plaid pantry, you know, so I was covered. And on my great amends tour of Portland in like 2006 or 2007, I went into that plaid pantry, and the guy looked at me. He grabbed me by the shoulders. He's like, "You're okay." I was like, "Yeah, I am." You know, because my life became something where you know, I couldn't fall asleep the night before if I didn't have a 12 pack of Pabst in the fridge because I knew I needed it in the morning. And so I woke up and drank beer like water and continuously throughout the day, and then later on in the day I'd have to amend, you know, some of those things with other substances and continue on into the evening. I started getting health problems really early on, like Sharonic gallbladder removal, ulcers, and the start of esophageal problems, and then I would mitigate that with drinking my Lanta and then drinking a shot and meat, you know, that sort of thing. And I spent a lot of time in the hospital, and I mean, man, it just didn't occur to me. Like, I had no idea that there was something wrong with me. I thought I was a bad person because I drank, and I drank because I was a bad person. And so when I was 21 years old, I had the mirror moment that I think a lot of us talk about. Thankfully, I was able to look in the mirror and actually see the reality of my situation for a brief moment, and I had yellow eyeballs, and I had that, like, I call it the Habsburg bloat. You know, I had like the really big face, but I weighed 80 pounds, you know, and my jaw was really heavy, and it was a Thursday morning, and I'd woken up with a busted lip and bruised ribs, and I didn't know how it happened, because I'm the type of, you know, I'm the blackout drinker that, like, wakes up in Idaho Falls, you know, in like a Super 8 motel with scabies, you know, and I'm like, why? And so, so I came out of that Thursday morning, I looked at myself in the mirror, and I was like, this is the best you can do. This is the best you can do. And I called my mama, and she was still down in Tucson, and she found Al-Anon later on, but at the time she had like a binder ready of all of the ways that she was going to help me. Like, I think there was collated tabs. If she says this, do this, do this. The red tab is go here. And so she went through her binder, and I ended up going into rehab. What was important about that phone call, and it was the first time I experienced this in my life, I spent about 10 minutes on the phone with her, and for those 10 minutes I desperately didn't want to drink again. I had the deep yearning sense that this was going to kill me. And it wasn't 5 minutes later that I put the phone down that I had to drink. And I hadn't experienced that before. I really thought that I never tried to control my drinking. And that was the first time that I realized that there was something beyond me, that allergy was beyond me, the craving was beyond me. And so I came out of that blackout on the way to rehab. And I believe that if you're going to detox, like, you got to make them work for it. So I was like downing them in the car, and I ended up in a place that I really lovingly call a psycho spa, but it was one of those places where it was like a 28-day program, and they feed you so well, you know, and then you go to group therapy, and then you get a massage, and then, you know, you get to go make malas, and then you can get a tan, and then yoga's over here, and it was one of those, oh God, I loved it. Like, you got to graduate from this place. I graduated after 28 days. And there's a ceremony where there's a drum circle, and like everybody's holding a rock, and there's a big pit, and you throw the rock in, and you say, "Alcohol, gone," you know, and everybody claps, you know, gone, it's gone, no more. And I really believed that. When I threw the rock, it was gone, you know? But it wasn't, because I'm an alcoholic. and in there, you know, I was always a good student, so I thought if I took copious notes, you know, if I learned the synaptic response of my brain when I put alcohol in my system, then, like, I'm going to know enough not to do it. And they would have things like make a list of triggers. And I love that list. I look at it sometimes. It's like cauliflower. Cauliflower is a trigger, you know? Left-hand turns, you know? And I was being really honest. Like, I was racking my brain about the things that have triggered me. And without the understanding that I'm an alcoholic and that waking up and simply opening my eyes is cause for me to drink. And so I left there with a lot of self-knowledge. What I did not leave there with, and I don't know if it was something about me just not having the ears to hear it, but I did not hear that I needed a power greater than myself to overcome my alcoholism. What I heard is that you get the right yoga regimen, you get the right SSRIs, you get the right intensive outpatient, you know, the right therapist, you read the right self-help books, and you can manage this. And I made it 4 months doing that. I would show up to parties, like, with my old people, and with, like, the big 32-ounce thing of Diet Coke, being like, "I'm sober now," and they knew me. And so what was happening was I was driving around Portland with mini bottles of tequila in the glove compartment, because I had heard in rehab that you were supposed to be altruistic. So my idea was that I was going to give the tequila bottles to the people that were panhandling and save them a trip to the liquor store. So it was better than giving them change. I was like, this is something I know about this, I'm gonna do this. And I experienced what the book talks about as a strange mental blank spot. You know, when I'm unable to bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. And I drank those bottles of tequila with no memory of doing it. Stone cold sober. Heavily medicated for the things that I had diagnosed myself as, but, you know, stone cold sober. And I actually came out of that blackout driving out here to Seaside. I was looking for walruses. It sounded like a really good idea. I swear I found them. I've been asking my host. I was like, where are the walruses? You know, can we go see the walruses? They're here, right? They're not here. There's there were no walruses. So I drank for another 9 months after that, and in that time, I tried to go back to school. I was really, 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 really trying to, like, you know, if I get the college degree, if I, the white picket fence, the hymn, the, you know, if I can arrange all of these things and make it look right, then I can maintain this life. And my world got smaller and smaller and smaller. I loved Sonia's story about the drunk bunker. I love it. I had a drunk bunker too, you know, but it was my hall closet, and I was scared of the mailman, and he would come bring bills through the flap of the door. And it wasn't that I couldn't pay him, it was that I couldn't physically open them, you know? And so I would wait for him, because I felt like if I could get the bills right away, then I would have the impetus to open them, and I could pay them, and then it'd be okay. And so I would wait for him and by my front door in a coat closet. And I lived in Portland, I didn't do my laundry. I would just buy new socks every once in a while. So I lived in this musty rat's nest of coats in my coat closet, and I wait for the mailman. And I eventually got just really comfortable there. I just got real grateful. My world is so big today. So I made it 9 months there. I decided Lewis and Clark College was the problem. And so I looked up online. This was in the early 2000s, so the Anarchist Cookbook was a really big deal. So I looked up online how to make Molotov cocktails, because I was going to go firebomb the campus. It's such a pretty school. But, you know, this is one of those instances of my alcoholism saving lives. I'm sure there were several. And I, you know, had my supplies for the Molotov cocktails. I was like, what a horrible waste of alcohol. So I'm just going to drink these. And I did. And because I'm also lazy. I'd like to say that I was compassionate, but I was lazy. And there was assembly required. So instead, I went to Lewis and Clark, and I withdrew without the possibility of readmittance, because that's going to show them. And they were gonna beg me to come back, and they didn't. And and so I packed up my Subaru, because you have to have a Subaru in Portland. And it was covered in blood in the back seat, and I packed it up with my feral cat and my overweight Rottweiler, because those were my last people. And I drove to Taos, New Mexico, and it was because where my mom was living there. And I ended up in Valdez, New Mexico, a little bit north of Taos. She didn't want me living with her. She put me in a little rat trap up there. And there was this little graveyard up the hill from me. And it was one of those beautiful New Mexico graveyards with, like, the marigolds and the wrought iron fencing. And I would go sit outside the graveyard and drink. And I made it 2 weeks in New Mexico before I went out to the little graveyard. My fat dog and I sat by the graveyard and drank. And I heard a voice. And it was the most beautiful voice. And it said, Camille, no matter what you do, you're going to drink again. And that was the first time I had any sort of experience with powerlessness. I was always of the belief that my precociousness, that my autonomy, that my skills would win out, and I would be able to manage this thing. And that was the first time that I heard, Camille, no matter what you do, you're going to drink again. And then my next thought was, I'm not going out like my sister. That was long and hard, so I'm going to try to kill myself now. And but I'm also vain, you know, so like I tried to cut my wrist, but I was like, I'm going to go really shallow, because like if this doesn't work, then I don't want scars. And so obviously it wasn't effective, and but the effort was kind of there. And I went home, told my mom about it, and the next day she had gotten me a bed at the county detox. And we talk about ego rebuilding itself really quickly. And so the night before, I was willing to die because I was licked by alcoholism. The next day, I'm driving to detox, and I walk in there with a man from the Tiwa Pueblo, and he was wearing a prison jumpsuit because he had been to court, and I think they changed him out of his clothes. And I walked in there with that man, and I looked at him, and in my head I was like, I'm better than this guy. I don't belong here. And this was the kind of, you know, like the bars on the windows and the plastic mattresses sort of joints. And so I went in there, I said, give me the drugs, give me 3 days, and I got this. And I sat down that night, and like that Tiwa Indian man is one of my angels. He sat with me, and we played Scrabble, and he beat the stuffing out of me at Scrabble. He licked me at Scrabble. And it was such a blessing, because I had the instant recognition of like, oh my God, I'm not that smart, you know? And there was this gentleman who, like, we're in the same spot, and my mental acuity and my grammar and all this stuff is not enough, you know? It's not enough. All the stuff that I thought was enough was not enough. And here I am, you know? I'm exactly where this guy is, and I need help. And so while I was there, thank God, right? So I stayed the 7 days, and I was 12-stepped by y'all. You know, there was a guy that came in there. His name is Richard Shea, he was a curmudgeon. We all called him Dick, and like he was a dick. and he had an oxygen tank. I used to call him the Darth Vader of recovery, because he's you know, throughout the whole meeting. And he came in and shared his story. And part of his story was that he had gone to really great lengths to try to overcome his drinking, and part of that was he is a whirling dervish. He was those people that spin and spin and spin and spin to get to like a hypnotic state, and he'd done that to try to overcome his drinking. And what I was able to see in there, while I had the experiential education with the first step on that hillside outside that graveyard, I was able to see that I was powerless over alcohol. What I saw with Richard when he came and spoke to me was, oh my God, AA worked for you, you know? And that was his message, and that's what I heard. And so I left that detox center, and I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was the How It Works group in Taos, New Mexico, which is a crazy group. And I belonged there for a couple years. I remember walking in the door, and not everybody has this experience, but it was a homecoming. And I remember how the dust was moving, you know, through the shafts of light coming from the window. And I remember the sticky tablecloths, and I remember the posters on the wall, and who was standing where. And there was only one woman in that meeting. And I don't like women. But I go sit down next to her, which is not of me. You know, that was not of me. I was at least, 30 years younger than everybody else in there. There's a bunch of dudes, and there was cowboy hats, and I was like, these aren't my people. But I went in, and I sat down, and I was also really convinced for a long time that I was the youngest person to ever get sober. I really thought that until I arrived at a meeting in a big city with young people in it, and there was a young girl in there. She was like 16 or something, and I was like, oh, how many months do you have? And she's like, 6 years. I was like, oh. I think I was like a year sober at the time. It was awful. It was awful. But I also love, you know, in the fourth tradition where it says the acme of humility is the capacity to laugh at ourselves. I love laughing. I could never laugh at myself. It was so serious. Now, like, I just, Chuckles McGee, I love it. And thank you for sharing your humor with me this weekend. So I walk in this meeting, I sit down next to this woman, and I don't like women, and, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but she was kind of methy and not sober, and but she had been around long enough to hear this stuff, you know, and even that woman was able to keep me in my seat. And I sat down next to her, and she said, she did that thing. She patted me on the hand, and she said, honey, you're never going to have to feel this way again if you don't want to. And it was something about that promise, that it wasn't about not drinking, that she understood how I felt was the most intolerable pain that I've ever felt, that it wasn't anger, it was rage, that it wasn't fear, it was terror. And she told me I didn't have to feel that again. And I don't know if I believed her or if I just, you know, nobody ever told me that. And so I stayed, and she, you know, went on to say, you know, I wish you could meet some of my sisters. And she was talking about the other women in the rooms. And this was, you know, when I then went on to work in the book and with a sponsor, and when I looked at a third step, I was able to recall this moment as being my experiential third step. And what I said to her was, I'll be your sister. And I want to offer that to all of you, I'll be your sister. So I joined that group. That was the kind of group where they had secret bylaws. You had to be a member for 6 months before you could even look at the bylaws. They did not contribute money to GSO because they disapproved of their litigious nature, and which has, I think, weight right now. But anyway, so they were nuts, and they, you know, in business meetings, I would be in fetal positions because, like, they're throwing chairs. But what I got to see was, like, they cared so deeply, and they had a tradition study, and I really got into the work, and they gave me the coffee job, and they gave me a key to the church, which I know a lot of us have that experience of being like, you know, I steal stuff, right? You know, but they gave me the key to the church, and I started making coffee for them, and. Like, I was feral when I came in here. I was a raccoon that was gnawing at your leg. I did not have life skills. I thought the DEA was after me. The best thing in my life was when somebody said, hey, that's a really great cup of coffee. You know? That made my week. It kept me coming back. In the spirit of rotation, they asked me to give up that coffee job. Nope. I thought that that was keeping me sober. They didn't take my key, they just appointed somebody else. So I would just show up earlier than the other person and make coffee and set out the cookies, you know, and then they'd show up, and I'd be like, oh, I was here. Eventually they took it away from me. But you know, in that time, what I got to experience, like an hour and a half before the meeting started, the coffee's made, and I'm sitting in this little church, and I start to have this experience with God. And my very first recollection of God, when I had that scary sponsor, she asked me to pick a conception, and you know, it's interesting. I'm glad that it worked out that way. I don't ask my girls to pick a conception. I ask them to pick an idea of what a relationship with God would look like. When I was asked to pick a conception of God, my small mind picked something so limited. You know, I came in here an atheist. I believed God didn't exist because I say so. And so when I was asked to come in and be an agnostic and be a Gnostic and be a seeker, I didn't have the skill set, you know? So I picked a first conception of God. My first idea was to be bratty, naturally. And I picked a hay truck. I lived in an agricultural community, and there were these large semi-trucks of hay that would go by, and it could feed a herd of cows, and that was something I couldn't do. And I started praying to the hay trucks. And wouldn't you know it, it worked. And not only that, the greatest joy for me, all over the world, people send me pictures of hay trucks. And like, it's in like downtown New York City, there's a hay truck going by, it's always there. You know, and it was such a blessing. And I started this very tentative dance with God of like, you know, it was a courtship. You know, it was a lot of coyness or obstinance from me, and it was this thing of like, please just let me trust you, you know? And I started to have experience with that. I was working in the book with a woman. I picked a sponsor, like Sharon says, that was louder than my head. And she had big red bouffant hair and a Jersey accent, and she wore pantyhose. And that was a conception of womanhood that I couldn't conceive of. And she scared the bejesus out of me. And she shared in her first meeting about being 26 years old on the side of a canal with two babies and realizing that she was just never going to snap out of it. And I heard that. And I asked her to sponsor me, and she started, thank God for that group. They were in the book, man. They loved the book. And she would say things like, read the black parts. And I, you know, I'm college edumacated, sort of, like I dropped out, but whatever. And I was too prideful to say, like, I don't know what you mean. She's like, read the words, you know, but I have all this subtext because my educational background is literary analytics. such a bleep show. It was a bleep show. And the first time I went over to her house was the first time I ever uttered a prayer in my life. And I got out of the car. I was still driving that bloody Subaru. And I opened the car door. She had a brand new Scion. It was really shiny and fancy. It was all dirt driveway. And I opened my car door. I forgot to hit my parking brake. And so my car started rolling backwards. And my car door bent against the bumper of her brand new car. And I had that moment of like, I can get out of here. And she probably can't track me down. Which was ridiculous because it was a small town. But I said my first prayer in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that first prayer was looking up at the sky, and it was a really high-pitched keening noise, like, ah! And I recall, that was a powerful prayer because that got in my feet, and my feet got in the door, and my mouth opened, and I was able to say, I need help. I just busted your car. I have insurance, surprisingly. But thus began our journey, and I didn't know how to turn a stove on. That woman came over to my house and taught me how to make French toast. I mean, the love that was shown, she would cut the mats out of my hair. But then she'd also piss me off. And she said I had to call every day. I didn't like that. So I'd call and just mouth breathe into the phone. And she knew it was me. When I was around, maybe 4 or 5 months sober, she told me, get in the car, pack a bag, get in the car. And we drove out to Norman, Oklahoma, which was a surprise to me. I didn't realize that was where I was going. And it wasn't on my list, you know. I was like, oh, Norman. And we end up in this Methodist boys camp at the Heart to Heart Al-Anon AA Women's Retreat, which I don't know if you guys have experienced that, but it's like, for a newcomer, it's the ninth circle of hell. Like, it's, you pull up and there's these women called pink ladies, and they have pink pom-poms, and they're cheerleaders. Like, they're the welcomers, and they want to hug you, and it's like, I was still wearing all black and carrying weapons, and then I go in, and like, later on, there was a bake sale. Oh. And, there was like a contest or something about who had the best pie, and like, I was very emo, but I was also, I had a sweet tooth, so I'm sitting in the corner, I'm like, I hate you, I'm eating your pie. And like, the straw in all of this was, later that night, there was a sing-along. Ugh. And Vinoy was leading the Al-Anon ladies in a march around the room, and they were singing When the Al-Anons Go Marching In, and I was like, I'm dead, and I have arrived. Hail Satan, you know. So again, I was in the fetal position, but there was a switch in me. I was on my sixth and seventh step, and thank God for the people that didn't glaze over that, you know, that told me that was the meat and taters. And I was on my sixth and seventh step, and I saw these women with abject joy and lack of self-consciousness and absolute gratitude for everybody around them. And I was like, I don't care. I will do a sing-along in Norman, Oklahoma the rest of my days if I can have what those women have. And I think, you know, like, there's times where I believe there's moments in our sobriety when we're all in. You know, and that was my all-in moment. And I went out to this little cedar chapel out there at that Methodist boys camp, and I hit my knees and said my seven-step prayer. And I tacked on the end, please God, help me be the woman you would have me be. And the rest of my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous has been that. I had a really skewed idea of what that looked like. I thought it meant, like, I baked a lot of cookies and, like, donated to the ASPCA, like, and wore linen, a lot of linen. And so it's also been about, like growing into myself, you know, like, and growing up with you and having you be, you know, my parents. And I was told, you know, you can't go to a dry well for water. You go somewhere else and get it, and then you bring it back. And my dad, that I hadn't spoken to, for ages, I started the amends process with him, and what I started out doing was I sent him a bouquet of yellow roses on the anniversary of his daughter's death, and a note that said, you know, Papa, I never told you how sorry I was for the loss of your daughter. Her death happened to me. I didn't realize that he lost a kid. And so that started the process. And I've made several amends to him. He's 90. One of the last amends I made to him, I was sitting down, and obviously I'm a crier, so I'm like weeping. And it's really emotional. I'm trying to tell him, you know, that I'm making every effort to take care of myself, you know, because he has a lot of fear about me. And he's like stony-faced, you know. He says nothing, and there's no response. He just kind of patted me on the hand, and I walked away, and I was like, no, you know, he will take my amends, and he will like it, and it will be wonderful, and I got mad, and then 2 days later, I came to find out, like, he didn't have his hearing aid turned on, like, he didn't hear me, so I've had to take different approaches, you know, and so I wrote him a letter, I never saw my dad cry. At the funeral of his daughter, he didn't cry. And when I got my one-year chip in that group in New Mexico, he came down from Denver. He said that, he stood up and he said that Irish blessing, you know, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. And the tears came down his eyes, you know. And so you've changed him. And we have a relationship today that's like, oh my God, the sweetness of it. This summer I moved him into assisted living. He didn't want to live with me. but he moved down the road. We were walking to dinner one night, and he can kind of hear. Like, if he's hearing aids, he can hear. But we're arm in arm, and he leans over to me. He says, Camille, I'm doing my best to make these people believe I'm deaf. Roll with it. And I was like... Okay. When I was around, 3 years, 2 years sober, I moved out to Tucson, back to Tucson. Scary sponsor gave me a beautiful pear tree to take with me and a note that said, grow where you're planted. And I killed the pear tree really quickly. But what I did was I grew where I was planted. And where I was planted in Tucson was into the young people's community. And I spent about a year with my head in my hands in meetings, you know. But I found this beautiful group, and, you know, I was starting to sponsor people and really settle in. And got to around 3 years sober, and I was on the road. I got in my car. I was headed out to a retreat in Los Angeles called Sunlight of the Spirit. And it was Sharon's baby retreat. She was my grand sponsor for many years. This retreat is at a nunnery. So my initial experience was being taken out to this nunnery at like 6 or 7 or 8 months sober. And I was like, this really solidifies the belief that you're going to make me become a nun, you know? So there's no cell phone reception, and there's peacocks, you know, which are idyllic and beautiful. But if you hear them screaming at night, it's really terrifying. And there's a picture of me at this retreat holding my cell phone up in desperation, like on a rock, being like, please, outside world. So I was on my way to Sharon's retreat, and my car broke down in Blythe, California. And up to this point, what I didn't realize was happening, but what was happening was that I was starting to use the steps and the traditions and the magic of this thing and the grace as a human tool. I love that line in the third step. It says, I'm in the delusion that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only manage well. And gosh darn it, I was managing really well. And I was exhausted. My car broke down in Blythe, and somebody from the retreat, I think, offered to come pick me up. And I was like, no, I'm fine. But it was because I saw the mechanic. And he drove a Thunderbird. And it was always like sunset behind him, even though it wasn't, whatever. I realized how tired I was of being the good AA, and I was so tired of having the right number of sponsees and the right service position, and like, you guys see I'm okay, right? You know, and I just wasn't. And so I took up with this mechanic instead of going to heart. And you know, obviously it ended well. He was holding a gun to my head, and I was like, you know, trying to make a life in like a double wide trailer in Blythe, California, you know, which is not where I saw myself. I was still sober. But the outcome of that was that I got really, really angry. And my fat dog died, you know, this is the culmination of things. And what it really was is that I was just exhausted. And so I started seeing a meditation therapist, because I thought I was meditating wrong. And I was paying for an hour-long session. And so she would do a guided meditation for 20 minutes, and for the rest of the time I would describe how I could kill her with the office supplies. Like, I was toasty. Like, I was having a rough time. And I went back to Taos to pick up a chip, and my sponsor took me out to the gorge, the Rio Grande Gorge out there, and she kicked me out of her car. And she swears to this day, this isn't what she said, but I remember this is what she said. She said, don't come back until you've hashed it out with God or you've jumped. Okay. So I went to the blanket, you know, And I love the tidal nature, like the tides, the in and out, the tidal nature of my relationship with God. When I was very newly sober, I had sudden and profound spiritual experiences. I was a brat, so I called them, instead of burning bushes, I called them smoldering shrubs. But like, they were big. I would feel the presence of a loving creator. And then it went away. And I don't know why. And so God was on my inventory for years. And I thought I was doing something wrong. And if I just prayed right, if I just accessed God right, that I'd be able to have that back, that sense of wonder, you know, and comfort. And it hasn't come. But what I arrived at out on that cliff and what I've seen with the glorious gift of sponsorship is that I've been afforded the opportunity to be able to look into your eyes and see you see God for the first time, and that's enough. Not only that, it's such a privilege to be able to watch you see your God. I was probably 9 or 10 years sober. Had a baby's meeting at my house. All my sponsees were over, and I got a phone call that man that had 12-stepped me in detox, that he was in the ICU in Taos. And the folks put me on the phone with him, and I got the opportunity, which I think is a really rare gift, to be able to tell the man that 12-stepped me into this new way of living how grateful I was and how much he meant to me. And when I got off the phone with him, I heard him say, "I love you, Camille." I said, "I love you, Dick." And hung up the phone. And I got in the car and I drove out to New Mexico. And I got there and come to find out, he'd been in a coma. I couldn't have heard him say those words, but I heard them. And he was sitting there in that ICU room, surrounded by his fellows in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the nurses kept saying things like, "This must have been a really important man. He was an a-hole, you know? Like, he was, he threw punches. Like, he didn't have the awards, and he didn't have the accolades, and he didn't have the letters behind his name. But what he had was this intuitive gift to show me the path across the bridge. And what we were able to do is we were able to sit there with him and hold the space for him for his passing. To be with him as he crosses the veil. And while I was sitting there, somebody handed me Psalm 23. They didn't know my story. And so I open it up and I read, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou art with me." And there was a magnitude to it. There was a fullness. And if I don't continue to show up day by day through the discomfort and the boredom and like the tragedy and the joy, if I don't show up for that stuff, then I can't see those moments. And those moments are worth more to me than anything. So I got to be a witness to my own little touch of like grace. You know, I met my husband in the rooms. It was very much boy meets girl on AA campus. We were a couple years sober, and I saw him across the smoky meeting room. He was chairing the meeting, and I was like, "I pick you," and didn't work out. It at that time. Worked out later. We moved in 2 months after starting dating. Whatever. Our sponsors thought it was a great idea. So good. And he's been one of my greatest teachers. What we've gotten to learn together as we grow up in this relationship and grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous is that my spiritual autonomy is the most important thing. That I can't be in a partnership. There can't be any unity in our love if I'm not spiritually autonomous. I'm getting close to God so I can bring that back. So I bring the water back to the well. God, we're so different. We don't even talk about AA. Because, you know, we just disagree on stuff. I'm right, naturally. And the work has been so good, you know, if I continue to show up for it. Like, recently my thing has been, you know, a complete denial of the narrative. And this is something that Jay has got given me. That if I can accept with the same level of, like, 100% unequivocal first step acceptance, that the narrative that I tell myself, the story that comes, that arises out of the emotion, if he doesn't wash the dishes, he doesn't love me, you know? And I go there, and if I can absolutely arrest that moment of, you know, creation of the story, and how much of that spills over into my daily life? You know, you cut me off in traffic, I start telling the story. How much time am I wasting when I have the opportunity to be in the presence of a loving God? How much of that am I wasting on the narrative? And we have two beautiful babies. Oh my God, guys, they are tornadoes. I was a quiet kid. I was a quiet, like, plotting kid, which is probably worse, but they're the whirling dervishes. They're my maelstroms. Two little boys, and when my oldest was 3 months old, I broke my leg. I shattered it. I had to be in bed for 3 months. I started developing really bad postpartum depression. My husband had to carry me to the shower. We both learned that from you. I let him carry me because I'm a flailer. You know, I was, don't touch me. You know, and he learned how to carry. And I just love the chances that I get to thank you for that. Little boys, I love this story. Sharon might have shared it 12 years ago. But it stuck with me, and especially because of these two little boys. And I had a sponsee a couple years ago with a little baby boy, and she wasn't willing to do the work. She wasn't willing to change. And she overdosed and died. And we didn't find her little baby boy for 2 days in his crib with his mama in the other room. And I got really angry. If I'm working a 12 step, I get to see you see God for the first time, but I also get to go back into the first step. I get to launched into these experiences where I had the belief that my kids are enough to keep me sober. And I couldn't have told you that was the truth, but I believed it because I was angry at her because her kid wasn't enough. And there's a story about this mama, and she's pregnant with her second baby boy, and the elder brother is, you know, really talking to the mom a lot and saying, hey, you know, when baby brother's born, I really need to talk to him. And she says, sure, whatever. I'm busy. So the baby's born, and big brother's pretty insistent about it. He's like, I need to talk to little brother. And finally the parents acquiesce, and they open the door to the crib, and the big brother goes in to talk to the little brother, and they're listening in, and big brother leans over the crib and he says, quick, tell me what God's like. I'm starting to forget. And forget, there's the tide between me and God. And I got news yesterday that several of the people that were in my lifeboat jumped out. And there's only a couple of us left from the beginning. And I got to sit in the midst of you and look at you, and I've been watching. I'm a watcher. And what you've given me is the quick. Tell me what God's like. I'm starting to forget. I can never tell you how thankful I am for that. You know, words don't show that. So I love you guys. Thank for being so generous with your spirit and your time and your stories. I believe God loves alcoholics because God loves stories. So please share them with me the rest of this weekend, and I look forward to getting to know all of you. Thanks.